In his memoir titled An Accidental Sports Writer, Robert Lipsight writes, "Sports writing isn't the oldest profession, although it is sometimes conducted that way." When Lipsight himself began writing about baseball players and boxers, he was determined not to become one of those sports writers who, quote, adore the events themselves and the heady access. Robert Lipsight joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game, or I should say welcome back to Only a Game.
Yeah, I'm glad you let me play again.
You began writing about sports more than 50 years ago. How soon did it become apparent to you that most of the newspaper sports writers were, quote, lodge brothers inclined to adore the events rather than function as reporters?
Well, I understood it pretty quickly, I think, but I mean, these lodge brothers really took me under their wing. They were wonderful. Jimmy Cannon, Red Smith, Arthur Daly. I mean, I was no threat, obviously. and I really didn't know that much about sports. Very quickly, I understood that the wonderful access that we had in those days came with a terrible price. That was, you could drink with the player or the coach that night at the bar, but you would never write about the bimbo he went upstairs with. and in a kind of a larger sense, you'd never really told the reader, the fan, who these people really were and what this was really all like.
One of the earliest experiences you had regarding how unpleasant heroic baseball players could be came courtesy of former New York Yankees center fielder Mickey Mantle. Tell us what happened when you asked Mr. Mantle about a fan who'd hit him in the jaw.
Well, he just very casually, and this is very casually, no malice or velocity, he just very casually looked over his shoulder and he made a rude and impossible suggestion. Actually, I reframed the question because I felt it was my bad, and he and Yogi Berra began throwing the ball an inch over my head, which I realized meant the interview's over. But it took me a while because I felt so humiliated. I asked a more experienced reporter, and he just kind of looked at me and said, welcome to the club. That's our Mickey. You should see him spit at kids who want autographs. And I go, why don't you ever write about that? Well, our readers don't want to read that, which is probably true.
You begin your memoir with a story about how you were bullied when you were a child. How did that experience inform your attitude when you began writing about professional athletes?
Well, you know, I've only really started thinking about that recently, and you are now one of my therapists in waiting. I guess it did. And I guess that my reaction to Mickey Mantle was an overreaction. You know, I should have said, well, he's a jerk, or he's having a bad day, or whatever, and just kind of moved on to it. But I immediately went into, you know, the fat boy mode, and this bully, and I was angry for years. You know, 25 years later, I'm interviewing Mantle in an abandoned country club bar. He had spent the whole day with, you know, executives. He had been paid to drink and play golf with them. Joker Stroke Golf, it's called. And he's pretty drunk by now, and we're having this really terrible interview. It's boring. He's dull. I figured, what the hell? Let's either shake it up or end it now. And I said, you know, Mick, I've never liked you. And his kind of eyes widened. And I told him the story. And he looked at me and he gave me that wonderful country grin. He raised his glass and he said, you know, I remember that really well, Bob. It's bothered me all these years, and that's the reason I became a drunk. And at that moment, I got Mickey Mantle.
Yeah.
I understood why Yankees thought he was a wonderful teammate. So after that, I started to become a Mickey Mantle fan.
Another of the athletes who influenced you was Muhammad Ali. When he was still fighting, did you ever get a clear sense of when you should take him seriously and when you should ignore him or just laugh?
You know, I'm not sure that there were clear delineations. I mean, he would say things, you know, which you couldn't get into the paper and maybe can't get on this broadcast. If you gave him a compliment, for example, he would just shrug, and he would say, I'm just a nigger trying to get bigger. Can you imagine Muhammad Ali would say that? And the most famous thing that he ever said, I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong. I happened to have been there the first time he said it. He had just found out that moment that his draft deferment had been canceled. Mm-hmm. He could be drafted now. And his first reaction was, why me? Why don't they draft all those poor boys in Louisville? Look at all the taxes I pay to buy them tanks and guns and airplanes. And in the course of a day, you know, where there were dozens and dozens of interviews of people hammering at him, you know, how do you feel about Vietnam? How do you feel about the Viet Cong? Do you know where Vietnam was? Of course he didn't. And finally, at the end of the evening, finally the last radio reporter says, so, champ, what do you think about going and killing some Viet Cong? And he said, I ain't got nothing against them Viet Cong. Mm-hmm. And boom, everybody saw the headline.
At one of the points where you became pretty disillusioned with writing about athletes and games, you got jump-started, as you put it, by NASCAR. How did that happen?
Well, this is my second hitch at the Times, and in a sense, I became an accidental sports writer all over again. Neil Amdur, the editor of the sports editor of the paper, had this wonderful idea to kind of refresh myself in the column, that I'd find a sport I knew nothing about. There were several, but NASCAR particularly. And so the idea was that, you know, as a dilettante anthropologist, I would go down to redneck heaven. And I went down there, met Dale Earnhardt, who was a fascinating character, became entranced by the technology and economics. I really loved the people because, you know, you cover baseball or football, you ask somebody a basic question, they'll kind of say, why doesn't your editor send somebody who knows something? In NASCAR, they'll sit down and explain what a restrictor plate is and, you know, show you the inside of an engine. I mean, a driver will do this. So I was really besotted. I loved NASCAR. And then the first race I actually covered, the Daytona 500 in February of 2001, Dale Earnhardt hit the wall right under where I was sitting. There had been wrecks before in that race, and people walked away. I didn't really take it seriously until all of a sudden the ground crew ran out and threw a blue tarp over his car. And the moment that happened, people in the press box began crying. And the 200,000 in the stands, there was kind of an animal gasp. They all knew, which I did not, that Earnhardt was dead.
Regarding the failure of most baseball writers to say anything about steroids during the summer when Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa were breaking the home run record, you write, and I'm quoting here, they left it alone not out of laziness or stupidity, but rather in the sweet moral corruption of love. Have any of your former colleagues taken issue with that theory?
No, because it's true. I hate to immodestly say I was right, but I was right. It wasn't venal. It was the feeling that baseball, their sport, their livelihood, was in a sense bringing the country back together after the horrors of the blue dress and the Republicans attacking Clinton and some really, you know, kind of nasty things happening in the society at large. Here we were coming together. This was all fun. As Murray Chass said, yeah, you could be investigative, but that wouldn't be fun. It was all jolly, and who wanted to rain on this delicious parade?
Longtime sports writer and columnist Robert Lipsyte is the author of An Accidental Sports Writer, published by HarperCollins. The author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Bob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill, and I'll write another book so I can come back sometime.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino, to whom we bid a fond adios. Best of luck with life beyond the candy store. Special thanks this week to technical subdirector Paul Vikas. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Ron Schachter's New York Cricket Photo Gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Dallas Morning News sports writer Jean-Jacques Taylor, who offers wisdom to anybody following the NBA postseason.
You know, it's not the glass is half full, it's not half empty, it's a half a glass of water.
Or in the case of any NBA team, half a glass of insert product placement here. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting Games for Health, working to use video games to improve health at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.